Mountain State Mysteries contains mature themes and discussions that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. All individuals mentioned in this episode are considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
Hey, y'all. I'm your host, Mark Covey.
And I'm Courtney.
And this is Mountain State Mysteries. The case we have for you today is one of the most infamous true crime cases to come from the Mountain State. If you want to hear about a case filled with strange twists, mysterious confessions, and unanswered questions, we've got you. So, Court, are you ready to dive into the West Virginia University co-ed murders?
I've been waiting on this one.
Good, because it's a long one, and we're going to be covering it in two parts. Morgantown, West Virginia is a college town in every sense. West Virginia University is the anchor of the city. It brings people from all walks of life who probably would have never met. And that's what it did in the fall of 1969, where two young women, Merritt Malarik of Kennelin, New Jersey, and Karen Farrell of Quinwood, West Virginia, paths would have never crossed if it wasn't for West Virginia University. Merritt grew up in New Jersey, where her father was a well-to-do dentist, which helped him keep his family in the upper middle-class lifestyle they knew. Karen's childhood was a little different. She was a coal miner's daughter. She grew up in a modest and religious household. After meeting, Merritt and Karen honestly didn't have much in common. However, they became fast friends during the first semester at WVU. The two lived on the same floor in Westchester Hall, located in the Beverly Manor, which was about halfway between the Main and Evansdale campus. Karen was known to be shy and kind, and Merritt was known to be outgoing and high-strung. And honestly, Court, I couldn't help but think about you and I during this, because I'm the high-strung, quiet one, and you are the very outgoing one that never meets a stranger.
This is very true.
January 18th, 1970, started out as a normal day for both Merritt and Karen. The two went to their classes, then stayed in their dorms for most of the day. At some point during the day, the two decided to go to the 7 p.m. showing of Oliver at the Metropolitan Theater in Morgantown, West Virginia. On their way to the movie, they stopped at the Sunnyside Supperette on University Avenue, where Merritt cashed a $10 check. When they arrived to the Metropolitan Theater, the two sat behind their friend, Paulette Burns, and her boyfriend, Clarence Lewis. Around 9:46 p.m., there was a short intermission, basically a smoke break during the movie. The four met in the lobby. Now, Clarence had never met Karen or Merritt, so Paulette introduced them. After this, they went back to their seats, and the four sat together to finish the movie. At 10:45 p.m., the four left the theater. Clarence asked Karen and Merritt how they were going to get back to Westchester Hall. One of them replied that they were just going to hitchhike. The four walked two blocks north on High Street. When they got to the intersection at Wiley Street, they all turned left, heading in the direction of the closest bus stop. Paulette and Clarence crossed the street to get to the bus stop. The two noticed that Merritt and Karen were in a vehicle passing them. Merritt was in the middle front seat, next to the driver, and Karen was on the passenger side. They noticed that neither of the girls seemed to be in any distress. They did find it odd that neither of them waved as they passed by. So, Court, what I find odd about this is that neither of them saw them get in the vehicle, and that neither of the girls would wave as they went by.
There's that, and the fact that they didn't acknowledge them as they drove by. But I'm not sure if something was said when they got in the vehicle or if the person driving had an eye, but I know I would have waved to two people I basically spent the entire evening with.
Right. Like, I know us, we would have waved, we would have acknowledged or been like, hey, we're getting in this vehicle, we'll see you at Westchester Hall.
I've like literally seen people like I have just left and pulled up next to them and I'll start staring and waving at them.
Yeah, because it's me.
There's you. There's been my, like, my coworkers, all kinds of, like, other people. I mean, it's just, like, normal habit.
So, I mean, something would have had to happen in the vehicle. I just don't know what. But I definitely think something was up. Now, the type of vehicle Merritt and Karen got into has kind of been a topic of debate. Paulette and Clarence have always said that it was a full-sized, four-door American sedan, which was, like, almost a cream color. The two said it resembled a 1965 Chevrolet Cadillac, or even a Plymouth. The light made it hard for them to get a good look at the driver. They described him as a white male in his late 20s, wearing a light-colored shirt, or maybe even a jacket. The car drove north on University Avenue, then it was out of sight. Neither Clarence or Paulette knew they would be the last ones to see Merritt and Karen alive.
Hey y'all, I'm Elisa.
And I'm Samantha.
And welcome to Watch for Deer Podcast. We're a couple of best friends from Southern West Virginia, and around here, Watch for Deer is our way of saying we love you and be safe.
This is a conversational podcast that covers many topics from A to Z, including, but not limited to, true crime and the paranormal. Our goal is to bring you an episode a week, so come listen as we tell stories that will make you laugh and maybe even blow your mind. Y'all be safe
and watch for deer.
As the night went on, the other girls who lived in Westchester Hall started to get worried after the midnight curfew. Instead of covering for them in hopes they would show up, they decided to tell the resident dorm assistant, Gwendolyn McClure. Less than 8 hours later, Gwendolyn contacted Morgantown Police Department to report Karen and Merritt. Not too long after the girls were reported missing, Chief of Police Bernie Palmer instructed that all relevant information on the girls was sent to the West Virginia State Police. After this, an all-point bulletin was sent out via teletype to other agencies and media outlets. Less than 24 hours after their disappearance, Karen and Merritt were making headlines in the Morgantown Post as well as being announced on radio station and the news channels. It wasn't long until authorities got their first lead. It was from a truck stop called JJ's in Ripley, West Virginia, which is 2 hours and 25 minutes away from Morgantown. Basically, the girls had been reportedly spotted climbing into the cab of a truck around 6 p.m. on the evening of Monday. The man who reported this identified the girls from their photographs. Police was able to track the trucker down who gave the girls a ride. He said he picked up the girls and dropped them off in Charleston. They told him they were headed to Ashland, Kentucky. Sadly, this lead went nowhere. The two girls who were hitchhiking in Ripley were found in Ashland, Kentucky, and sadly, it wasn't Karen or Merritt.
Months went by, and on March 1st, a 13-year-old boy named Stephen Trinkett and his younger sister were walking along US 119, better known as Grafton Road, collecting pop bottles. They stumbled upon something that would start a new lead in the investigation. Court, do you want to guess what it was?
The bodies of Merritt and Karen?
Sadly, no. They found a brown purse, which had the ID of Merritt Malarik in it. So, with this being found, authorities were kind of left scratching their heads. They weren't sure if the purse had been stolen, then discarded, or if it had been thrown out of the vehicle by Merritt herself. By the middle of March, the disappointment of students, friends, and families reached its way to Charleston, West Virginia, and the office of Governor Arch Moore. Basically, the pressure of the public made Moore call State Police Sergeant Robert Boner to his office. I did try to find out what was said during this meeting, but sadly I couldn't. I do know that Moore's message was clear AF. Whatever you need, you've got it. Just find those girls. This made Boner motivated, and he decided to pay a visit to the state police in Shinston, and was shocked to learn that little to no movement had been made following the discovery of Merritt's purse. A new search started in the case. State police started searching the woods near where the purse was found. During the first week of April, a group of students from West Virginia University paid Governor Moore a visit. They brought a petition with them containing over 2,700 signatures, basically urging the governor to request the FBI to enter the investigation. This call was asked by West Virginia locals, including the West Virginia University president. Students even wanted to team up and hire a private investigator to solve this case. So, Court, you know I've been talking about Merritt's purse.
Yeah, was there something else found with it?
I wish. The thing I haven't told you yet is that there's kind of been a secret with the police and the purse.
What do you mean?
They didn't announce that it was found till April 6th.
Why would they keep it a secret for that long?
Girl, I wish I could tell you. And that same week, something a little shocking happened. Merritt's roommate, Donna D. Young, gave authorities an anonymous letter she received, mailed on Sunday, April 5th, and postmarked from Cumberland, Maryland. The letter basically said that both of the girls were dead and that their bodies could be found within a 25-mile radius of Morgantown. On April 8th, the state police in Morgantown received somewhat of the same letter, also postmarked from Cumberland, Maryland. In court, it's a little too crazy, but I put it in the document. Do you care to read it?
Gentlemen, I have some information on the whereabouts of the bodies of the two missing West Virginia University co-eds, Merritt Millerick and Karen Farrell. Follow directions to the 9th degree, and you cannot fail to find them. Proceed 25 miles directly south from the southern line of Morgantown. This will bring you to a wooded forest land. Enter into the forest exactly 1 mile. There are the bodies. 25 plus 1 equals 26 total. Will reveal myself when the bodies are located. Sincerely, Triangle. Triangle, wait, who's Triangle?
Well, the police doesn't know yet. State troopers began a focused search along Route 119 near the county line. This search wasn't small. Either you had officers on the ground or National Guard in helicopters circling the area.
Were they able to find anything?
Sadly, no. But two state troopers traveled 25 miles south of Morgantown and ended up in Grafton, West Virginia. On April 11th, police received what you would call a correction.
A correction? What do you mean?
Well, they received another letter from Triangle.
Gentlemen, I saw the article in this morning's newspaper concerning my previous letters on the two missing co-eds. If you reread my first letter carefully, you will see the directions were specific, direct, south from the city, running the southern limit of Morgantown, West Virginia. Straight south, 25 miles, you will come to a forest woodland. Enter in south 1 mile. Facing out, you will locate the bodies of the girls covered over with brush. Look carefully. The animals are now on the move. Do trust this will help you out to spot location. Will still identify myself when bodies are located. Sincerely, Triangle. The animals are on the move. Does this mean Triangle is going to kill again?
No, I mean, it's April, it's starting to warm up some, so animals are starting to move around again. I guess Triangle was referencing that the animals could eat away at the bodies and make it harder for police to find the girls. After this letter, state police was helped by members of the Monongalia County Rescue Squad and the Marion County Police Reserves. Sadly, with this search, it was another failed attempt to find the girls.
Hi, I'm Shane.
I'm Hannah.
And we're Country Roads Creeps. We're a podcast that covers all manner of creepy, spooky stories, from cryptids and conspiracies to unexplained deaths and disappearances to mysterious and paranormal happenings in the world.
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts. Check out our Facebook page and our Instagram account at Country Roads Creeps for photo dumps and more information we'll post with every episode.
If you enjoy the show, please feel free to share us with your friends and leave us a 5-star review. And if there's any topics that you'd like to hear us cover in the future, feel free to message us on our social media accounts. Is that it?
That's it.
All right. Well, be safe driving home and watch out for the not deer.
Bye.
Bye.
Sunday, April 12th, the search continued, moving northward. Around noon, a traveling salesman named Fred Stewart saw officers walking through the woods. He pulled over and decided to join them. He happened upon a slightly weathered eyeglass case. On the case, he saw the words Seymour Pollock, 159, Van Houten, Op Patterson, YMMA. Inside the case, there was a pair of large-rimmed women's glasses. After Stewart turned the glasses into the police, 2 days later, they were identified as Merritt's glasses. This sent the search into overdrive. By April 14th, the area south of Morgantown started to resemble what some would call a combat zone. There were 100 guardsmen from the 201st Artillery Unit of the West Virginia National Guard. Most of the searchers went west along Halleck Road, and a few went north. Some of the searchers found a soggy suede pocketbook, which ended up belonging to Karen Farrell.
Where did they find it?
About 0.4 miles from the location where Merritt's purse has been found. Along Halleck Road, the National Guardsmen and police found medicine bottles, a hairbrush, and some small pieces of glass. The bottle was identified as one of Merritt's. It was a prescription for pain. She was having some issues with the tooth, and a dentist prescribed her the medication. Later in the evening, several pieces of makeup were found in the same area.
So, it was like they were throwing items, making a trail.
That's kind of the general idea. During the next few searches, they kept finding items belonging to the girls. At 11 a.m. on April 16th, 1970, National Guardsman Steven Slavinsky was walking along his route in a location called the Weirton Mine area. Steven was drawn to kind of a flat, opened area near Owl Creek. He decided to break away from his group to check out some of the area. He worked his way north from the road about 400 feet when he came to a tree with a large hole in it. About 10 feet below the tree, he noticed a pile of leaves and brush. In the pile, he noticed a foot with a shoe.
Does this mean what I think it means?
At 11:30 a.m., Steven Slavinsky ran back to his group to tell them he found Karen Farrell and Merritt Malarek.
Hey y'all, I'm Elisa.
And I'm Samantha.
And welcome to Watch for Deer Podcast. We're a couple of best friends from Southern West Virginia, and around here, Watch for Deer is our way of saying we love you and be safe.
This is a conversational podcast that covers many topics from A to Z, including, but not limited to, true crime and the paranormal. Our goal is to bring you an episode a week, so come listen as we tell stories that will make you laugh and maybe even blow your mind. Y'all be safe
and watch for deer.
Not too long after the scene was sealed off, the road was swarmed with police and National Guard. Of course, word spread fast through the mountains, and police found themselves fighting a battle, trying to document the crime scene, and the other members were fighting off the press.
How bad was it with the press?
I mean, I would say it's as crazy as it is today. I mean, the story was front page news for 88 days. Everyone wanted to have this on the front page of the newspaper. Actually, one man who worked for the Dominion News, Ron Ritterhouse, had his film confiscated by a state police trooper. So while Owl Creek was sealed off, officers began documenting and processing the crime scene. They removed the limbs and rocks, piece by piece, from the makeshift tomb.
The remains of the girls were deteriorated. They were both found face down in an extremely shallow depression. Karen was on top of Merritt. Their clothing was clung to their body and matched what they were wearing the night they disappeared. The worst part of the scene was that both Merritt and Karen were both missing their heads. Monongalia County Coroner William Bowers arrived and was escorted to the scene. He said that the girls' bodies had been hidden quite well and that he likely would not notice them if he walked by. He also said that the decapitation was not caused by animal activity. But by some type of tool. Monongalia County Prosecutor Joseph Larita authorized an autopsy to be held at the West Virginia University Hospital. Not too long after this, the bodies of Karen and Merritt were taken out of Owl Creek Hollow and loaded into an ambulance.
So later that night, West Virginia Police Superintendent Bonar did a briefing with reporters on the events of that day. He was asked if a cause of death had been determined, and he said, no, definitely not. There hasn't been any cause of death. Of course, this will require a detailed doctor's examination to an effort to determine how the two bodies found did meet their death. He then went to talk about the search and how it led to their discovery. The following day, while everyone was dealing with the public, medical personnel at West Virginia University Hospital tried to make sense out of the decomposed remains. Merritt Malaric was examined by pathologist Milton Hales, and Karen Farrell was examined by pathologist Hiroshi Suzuki. Now, even though both of the bodies were decomposing, both of their right hands were still good enough to get usable fingerprints. They were actually compared to the fingerprints found on notebooks found in the girls' dorm rooms. This basically removed all doubt. It was in the paper the next day saying the girls were identified by their fingerprints. The next day, authorities returned to Owl Creek Road where the girls had been discovered. When I say they searched this area, they went above and beyond. They even searched the draining of a nearby pond. Sadly, the search didn't lead to any new information.
So, during their search, did they find anything to do with Triangle's letters?
It's funny you asked, because they actually traced them to Cumberland, Maryland.
Did they find the killer?
No. What they found was a religious group and their leader who actually admitted to writing each of the letters. He told authorities that he obtained the information from higher powers.
So, did they think he killed the girls?
No. It was actually in the Morgantown Post. It said that it's been determined that the letter writer was not involved in the crime scene at all. I guess this guy believed that he was psychic and that he could tell police all of these information in, like, letter form. And they actually found, like, his writing matched up with another letter that he tried to solve another case of a missing girl in some other state. So, after this, authorities found themselves back at square one, trying to find out how Merritt and Karen got from Willie Street in Morgantown to the abandoned strip mine 12 miles away. From the location they were picked up, authorities knew there could have only been four possible ways their killer could have taken to get to Owl Creek. The most direct would have been if the killer went south on US 119 to Goshen Road, then went to Owl Creek Road from Goshen Road.
So the killer would have to know the area.
To me, it seems that way. But get this. None of the four ways had any of the items that belonged to the girls that were found by the road. All of the items were found south of where the bodies were located.
Is there a pattern to how the items were thrown out of the car?
No, in all honesty, I'm not even sure if they ever found out if it was the girls who threw the items out or if it was the killer as he was driving away, either to the location or from the location. So the killer would have to drive south, east, north, then south again to throw out all of these items where they were found.
Did they ever figure out what exactly the motive was?
I mean, to anyone, it was a guessing game.
What do you mean?
Well, given that both of the girls were fully clothed, the question of if they suffered sexual assault was thrown to the side. Some wanted to focus more on a drug-induced killing of the girls, but the physical violence that happened to both of the girls indicated rage and that the killer was driven to overkill. The only thing that were missing from the girls at the time of their murders were Merritt's underwear, 3 shoes, and Karen's coat. They still have never been found to this day.
Hi, I'm Shane.
I'm Hannah.
And we're Country Roads Creeps. We're a podcast that covers all manner of creepy, spooky stories, from cryptids and conspiracies to unexplained deaths and disappearances to mysterious and paranormal happenings in the world.
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts. Check out our Facebook page and our Instagram account at Country Roads Creeps for photo dumps and more information we'll post with every episode.
If you enjoy the show, please feel free to share us with your friends and leave us a 5-star review. And if there's any topics that you'd like to hear us cover in the future, feel free to message us on our social media accounts. Is that it?
That's it.
All right. Well, be safe driving home and watch out for the not deer.
Bye.
Bye.
The one thing that no one suspected is that over 300 miles away in Camden County, New Jersey, an inmate at the Camden County Jail named Eugene Paul Clausen was suffering from night terrors. They seemed to bother Clausen so much that he felt the need to relate the terrors to other inmates. On January 9, 1976, Kenneth McCarty with the Morgantown Police Department received a call from Sergeant Robert DePersia with the Camden County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, told him that an inmate at the county jail had reported hearing about Eugene's night terrors. He said that Eugene confessed to him that he had murdered and decapitated 2 young girls in West Virginia years ago. Eugene claimed that he was being haunted by the events in his dreams.
McCarty was skeptical but reported it to J.E. Parsons of the West Virginia State Police. They actually stayed cautious since the news of the double murder went public.
Why did they stay cautious? Did they not believe him?
I think they stayed cautious for the simple reason that less than half of a dozen people confessed to the murders already. Like, it was kind of a quick 10 minutes to fame. Plus, the name Eugene Paul Clausen was unknown to the West Virginia State Police. On January 13th, Sergeant Mitchell, Detective James McCabe, and State Police Trooper D.M. Shade took a trip to New Jersey. They wanted to interview Eugene in person. Around 9:30 p.m., Eugene waived his right to his lawyer being present and gave West Virginia authorities a statement. Now, I could only find a few parts of his confession.
From here to the curtain, away from the car?
The curtain.
Didn't you tell me when you were talking earlier, you walked them back into the woods, and I said how far?
It was in the woods.
You said it was so far back in the woods I couldn't see the car.
No, I said I can't see the road.
The road?
The road.
Now, you're telling me.
I couldn't see the main road.
You're not talking about the dirt road now. You're talking about the main road?
I couldn't see the main road.
Now, how far off of the dirt road do you think you took them?
I couldn't see the main road from the dirt road where I had them. I thought that's what you asked me before.
How far from where your car was parked did you take them back into the woods?
I walked back in the woods. I could see the car, but I thought when you asked me.
Sadly, that's all I could find. From the statement, I searched the West Virginia Co-Ed Murders book, the Appalachian Mysteria podcast, websites, articles, you name it, I searched it, I couldn't find it.
Did he say what he did with the girls' heads by chance?
He said he removed them with a machete, which belonged to his brother, and he said he disposed of the heads near an old schoolhouse right outside of Point Marion in Pennsylvania. He said, I threw both of the heads and the rag down, all in one of those holes with the gun.
Was the gun in the rag too?
No. No.
You threw the heads down and then the gun?
No. I threw the gun in first and then the heads.
And the rag and all went down in?
Yes.
Then what did you do?
Then I came back out on Storktown Road. I turned the car around, got on Storktown Road, and went down a little toward Point Marion.
Which, Court, this was less than 2,000 feet from the house he grew up in.
You're kidding me.
Really wish I was, girl. He actually gave 3 of the West Virginia officers detailed directions to the location. So, they went to where he said he dumped the heads. He also told them that he gave the machete back to his brother. When they got back to West Virginia, Trooper Shade and the others actually paid a visit to Eugene's brother, James. They ended up taking the machete. The next day, they took a trip to the location where Eugene said, now, this area is known as Con Hill, and it's basically an open field on a bluff looking over the Cheat River. Following Eugene's directions, they searched an area 25 to 35 feet from the edge of a rocky cliff. To them, it just seemed like his description, but it seemed much, much more even and taken care of than how he described it. It was actually the same location. You see, the owner of the property leveled it, so it did look different than how it looked back in 1970. He also said that there was an old coal mine under the area that he converted into a grazing field. So you want to guess what they did next?
Went back to Morgantown.
I mean, in all honesty, that's what I thought. But Sergeant Mitchell and the owner of the property went over the cliff and made their way down about 40-ish feet to a small opening leading into a mine shaft. Sadly, they didn't find the heads of Marin and Karen in the mine shaft.
On January 15th, Trooper Shade decided to call New Jersey to see if he could get a more detailed description of the location Eugene was talking about. Eugene said he would be willing to guide the men to the right location where he disposed of the heads. Even though they were still skeptical, authorities in both West Virginia and New Jersey agreed that this meant a long overnight trip for Eugene and Camden County detectives John Giletto and DiMaggio.
At 1:30 p.m. on January 16th, Trooper Shade, Eugene, and others from West Virginia and New Jersey went to Con Hill. Eugene said he used to play in the area, but when he was there, he seemed confused and said it didn't look the same to him. He said on the night of the murders, he disposed of the gun and the heads in 3 different holes. Eugene actually became irritated when Trooper Shade asked him if he was sure if he got the right location. Eugene continued to look at the area and eventually pointed to the location where he disposed of the heads. The area did match up with the mines below. After this, they actually took Eugene to Morgantown and asked him to show where he picked up Merritt and Karen. It said he guided them to Willie Street and pointed to a location just a few feet from where the girls had last been seen. Investigators were trying their best to keep this part of the investigation close to the vest. However, that afternoon, Governor Moore issued a telephone press release to announce the new developments. He did keep out Eugene's name, but everything else was a free-for-all. Later that evening, David Solomon, a Monongalia County prosecutor, announced that Eugene Paul Clausen was the main suspect.
So why did they release his names?
Well, he was kind of pissed at Governor Moore, and in all honesty, he didn't hold back, saying, quote, "Governor Moore has impaired and impeded this investigation since the beginning. With his handling of the news from Charleston, this is both improper and contrary to the police investigation and procedure. The only reason he can do this is he controls and manages the state police and appoints the superintendent. His announcement was premature and unwarranted," end quote. So after this, Trooper Shade and Detective McCade went back to New Jersey with Eugene and recorded a statement with him. This time, his attorney was present. He again waived his right to remain silent and gave them basically the same statement.
On January 17th, West Virginia State Police and the West Virginia Bureau of Mines began excavating the site. And sadly, they declared the location too dangerous for any more excavating on February 2nd. Over the next 2 months, authorities continued to investigate Eugene. He kept his account and even confessed to the murders 3 separate times under hypnosis. At this point, it was kind of split. Some believed him, some didn't. For the most part, he remained consistent. I mean, he would change a few details here and there. Most of the time, it was on the vehicle he drove. However, he said his memory was foggy because he took LSD and smoked some weed that night.
On April 6, 1976, Prosecutor David Solomon formally sought a grand jury indictment against Eugene Paul Clausen. And on April 8th, the Monongalia County Grand Jury returned a true bill indictment against Eugene for 2 counts of first-degree murder. Eugene was sent to Morgantown, where he was arraigned at the Monongalia Courthouse on May 19th. Bond was refused, and Leon E. Friend of Morgantown was appointed to serve as Eugene's public defender. After all of this, Eugene actually pled not guilty to 2 counts of first-degree murder. His trial date was scheduled for June 28, 1976. The trial didn't actually begin until October, which you'll have to wait and listen to next week. If you find yourself enjoying Mountain State Mysteries, take a second to follow, download, and rate the show on your favorite podcast platform. It helps others find good West Virginia true crime podcasts.
Don't forget to follow us on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook, all at Mountain State Mysteries.
Do you have a case you want us to cover? Send us an email at mountainstatemysteries304@gmail.com.
For the show notes, check out our website, mountainstatemysteriespodcast.com.